This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. As winter tightens its grip, it seems that communicable diseases also flourish. It's flu season. Pockets of whooping cough are emerging. Mumps, too. Why are some vaccine-preventable diseases getting a foothold? Are we becoming too complacent about dangerous diseases, or are those diseases becoming more resistant? Is vaccine protection waning, especially for senior citizens who are depending on childhood immunizations? We'll be hearing from state epidemiologist Patricia Quinlisk and pediatric infectious disease specialist Louis Castagnini. And we'll be taking your questions and comments on our toll-free telephone lines or internet connections. Infectious diseases and what we're doing to protect ourselves. It's The Exchange, right after the NPR News. Dean Borg continuing The Exchange, and we're going to be talking about diseases, childhood diseases, many of us consider them, but we're going to find out, I think, that there are a danger to those of us who are older adults and even senior citizens. We're going to be talking with Dr. Patricia Quinlisk, the state epidemiologist at the Iowa Department of Public Health. Hello, Dr. Quinlisk, you're in our Des Moines studio.
I am. Hello there, Dean.
And Dr. Louis Castagnini, pediatric infectious disease specialist at Blank Children's Hospital in Des Moines, is also in our Des Moines studio. Hello, Dr. Castagnini.
Hello, good afternoon.
Dr. Quinlisk, what's the current situation? Are we seeing a resurgence in some diseases that we considered conquered?
Yes, unfortunately we are. Some people might know that California has had a large outbreak of pertussis or whooping cough, causing the deaths, unfortunately, of quite a few children. So, yes, we are seeing some of these diseases come back. Now, here in Iowa, we've been fortunate. While we're having some outbreaks of things like whooping cough, we have not yet seen deaths this last year or this year.
What are you talking about in the way of numbers of cases? Significant, like 60 to 100 or 10 or 12?
Well, last year we saw over 600 cases of whooping cough in Iowa, and I'll just tell you that's a tip of the iceberg because basically the only people who get tested so that we can find out whether they truly have whooping cough are children who are pretty seriously ill. So children who have less serious symptoms, and most adults never even get tested. So the 600 is probably a very small number of the actual people who got whooping cough last year in Iowa.
I'm surprised that you're saying that, though, because from what I understand about whooping cough, is you know when you've got it.
Well, when you're a baby or a young infant, yes, you know when you've got it because the children will have a whoop or have vomiting after they cough because a cough is so serious. But actually, if I got whooping cough, I might just have a sort of an aggravating minor cough that lasts a month or two. But other than that, I might not have any symptoms.
What about mumps and measles? Significant outbreaks of those?
Well, as you probably know, a couple of years ago, we had a very significant outbreak of mumps, over 1,000 cases in here in Iowa alone. Now, fortunately, again, we were able to go out, really get people vaccinated, really calm down that outbreak. But every so often, we do get mumps coming back. We had a little cluster of about, oh, I think it was 10 to 12 cases last year in northwest Iowa. Now, measles, fortunately, we have not had measles in Iowa for several years, but we're always concerned because people can go to another country, particularly pick it up and bring it back to Iowa and then spread it here, as happened about 6 years ago.
Dr. Castagnini, what do you see when patients who have these diseases come to see you? And are you concerned about the outbreaks that Dr. Quinlisk is describing?
Well, certainly we are very concerned about outbreaks. Whooping cough is an illness that can be deadly, especially in small children. Most of the studies show that children less than 6 months of age will be hospitalized, and a certain percentage of those will die from the disease. About 1% is the case fatality rate. So every time I see whooping cough, that means that there's a spread of disease in that household.
Have you seen
or even in schools.
Have you seen some already this year?
Yes. We've seen most of them are adolescents. And when you mean this year in 2011, I have not seen, but I saw one in December, and certainly we can see more in the near future.
And 2011 is right. That is this year, but I guess I was speaking more of the season and from the fall on to the current time. But you say you have seen whooping cough cases in the Des Moines area.
Yes, correct.
Do you see them in a certain demographic area, that is, geographic area of the city or that metro area around Des Moines, where I would guess your patients would be coming from? Or is it just across all economic strata?
Well, actually, whooping cough crosses all economic strata. Some studies suggest that this illness is more common in Hispanic descent, and some Hispanics might be at higher risk of acquiring the illness and having complications. But what I've seen here in Des Moines is that most of the patients are coming from everywhere in the city.
Dr. Quintus, why is that, that Hispanics may have a tougher time with whooping cough than other ethnicities?
Well, it might be something as simple as less access to vaccines or for a lower vaccination rate. Also, we know that this is a disease that spreads easily. So, for example, if you have a household that has a lot of children in it, you might get more readily spread among those children who then go to their schools and spread it more easily also that way. So it could be some of the just demographics of the household that could put you at higher risk.
Dr. Castagnini, what is it about these diseases? Whooping cough, you said, very, very concerning in infants. What is it about these diseases that make them so concerning to you and make us want to immunize against them in the first place? Yes, they're deadly, but do they have follow-on consequences too?
Yes, sure, definitely. And most of the patients that are severely ill are small, and that's because of the anatomy. Their airway is very small. So the inflammation that this disease causes will cause more severe disease in them. And as also Quinslick said before, adults may have just a mild cough and not seek for health for their healthcare provider. But small babies be hospitalized, intubated, and possibly die. If they survive the disease, they can have severe sequelae as well. They can have brain damage because of low oxygen delivered to the brain during the illness. They can have severe, cerebral palsy after that, or seizure disorders because of encephalopathy produced by this illness.
Dr. Quintus, why, as you look at this, is it puzzle you as to why whooping cough and some of these other things we've been talking about, mumps, I remember them in my childhood. But then, as I raised my children, didn't hear much about mumps. Now they're back again. Why are we seeing resurgences in diseases like this and others?
Well, unfortunately, part of the reason why we're seeing some of these diseases come back is because parents are not wanting to vaccinate their children. They don't realize that these diseases are out there, and they're leaving their children vulnerable when they don't get vaccinated. We think that the mumps, for example, got imported from probably the British Islands because they were having a large outbreak before we saw our mumps here, and it was the exact same strain. And we know that the measles that came in from India, but on an American who was not vaccinated. So, unfortunately, a lot of these diseases are because people have made the decision not to vaccinate their children and leave them vulnerable. We also know that the vaccines are not as effective as we would want. I don't think there's probably any vaccine that's 100% effective. Now, they're still better. They help you lower the risk, particularly of having serious disease if you're exposed, et cetera. But there's just no vaccine we have out there that gives you a 100% guarantee that you won't get the illness. So in order to have protection, we need to have two layers. One, we have to have the person vaccinated so they have the immunity and everything produced by the vaccine so that they have their own personal protection. But then the second thing we have to do is vaccinate everybody around that person so that they have a very low risk of even being exposed to that disease. So we get that two layers. And that's just talking again about the pertussis in the babies. Babies are often too young to get these vaccines. So one of the best things we can do for these children is called cocooning. We need to provide a protective cocoon around those very young children. And that cocoon is basically that everybody who comes in contact with those children are vaccinated so that they can't bring the disease to the child.
I'm going to bring a caller on the line here now who is asking, as I understand, Dawn is calling from Nevada. Dawn, I'm going to let you ask the question. Thanks for joining us. Dawn, are you there? I think maybe we lost Dawn. She had been waiting time. We should say that if you want to ask a question as we go along here, call us at 866-780-9100 or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org if you'd like to use the Internet. Again, 866-780-9100. I'm going to also introduce Dr. Patricia Quinlisk, who's in our Iowa City studio. Quinlisk is in Des Moines. Dr. Patricia Winokur. Pat Winokur is from University Hospitals. Too many Pats on the show here today.
Well, thank you. Appreciate having me.
Dr. Winokur, you are a researcher in vaccines.
Exactly. And so Dr. Quinlisk's statement that we wish our vaccines were more effective is exactly what I'm working on, is trying to develop vaccines that are a little bit better.
What kind of research are you into right now?
So we actually have been doing quite a bit with influenza over the past few years. We were interested in influenza before H1N1, and we particularly are interested in H1N1 still. We've been looking at ways to better protect the elderly from influenza vaccines, and this year we're actually looking at better ways of protecting infants from influenza disease. We've got a study ongoing right now looking at whether we can use higher doses of vaccine in babies to try and improve the protection of the influenza vaccine.
I'm going to ask the question that Dawn had posed, and she was wanting to know about the consequences of having chickenpox later in life and as it relates to a disease called shingles. Dr. Quinlisk?
Yeah, and, you know, I must admit, I sort of admire the chickenpox vaccine because it's figured out how to get past some of our protections. And the way it does that is when a child gets chickenpox, it has the typical poxes, the skin lesions, and they get sick and in most cases get over it. But then the virus doesn't go away. It hides out in nerves, and it may hide out in those nerves for decades. And then when that person gets older and, say, is a grandparent who might be taking care of their grandchildren, the virus sort of pops back out onto the skin in something called shingles. And then if the grandparent takes care of the grandchild, they can expose the child to the chickenpox virus, and the child will actually get chickenpox, not shingles. Now, this is pretty serious, though, in older people, because if you've ever talked to anybody who's had shingles, it's a horrible, horrible disease. Since the virus is in the nerves, it causes immense amounts of pain and can actually lead to nerve damage. So one of the things that's happened recently is we now actually have a vaccine to give to older people who have had chickenpox as a child. We give them this vaccine, and it reduces the risk of them getting shingles when they're older. So I'll just tell you, I'm getting close to that age, and I know I had chickenpox as a child, and I'll plan to be getting that vaccine in about 4 years.
Dr. Cascadini, does that also apply? We're talking about chickenpox and shingles here, but does that also apply to the other diseases we've been talking about? Could an older adult be harboring, say, whooping cough? I think we've already said that some people have whooping cough, don't even know it. But without passing the disease on to others who may be like them, older, but caring for their grandchildren, great danger. What's your advice to grandparents?
Well, definitely the best way to prevent whooping cough is getting immunized. And
The grandparent, too?
Yes, definitely. Vaccine against pertussis, we have two types. One that is provided to small children at 2, 4, 6 months of age, and then boosters at 1 year of age, and then 4 to 6 years of age. But now there's another vaccine licensed in 2005 called the Tdap. And that vaccine is recommended for children at 11 to 12 years of age and adolescents. And you should get that vaccine up to 65 years of age. Right now, the recommendation is to provide one dose if you have not gotten that vaccine before. It's a replacement of the tetanus vaccine that we used to get before that. So anybody in the range from 11 to 65 years of age should get this vaccine.
I might want to add that they're probably going to be coming out with a recommendation very soon for anybody over 65 years of age who takes care of young children that they should also get that vaccine just because of the risk we're talking about, that they can bring pertussis into those infants. So,
who are you saying they might be coming out? Who's that?
Oh, I'm sorry. The national recommendations, and those come out from a group called the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, which is a group of people from all over the country who are experts on this. And they've looked at this because of the risk that we've been discussing about the grandparents, for example, bringing it into the infants. And even though the vaccine, when it was licensed, only went up to 65 years of age, in other words, they're saying only get it up to 65 years of age and then after that don't get it. But, of course, because of what we've been talking about this morning, the grandparents offer to take care of these children and that they may be over 65 years of age. So the recommendation is going to be for even people over 65, if you take care of young children, you should get this vaccine too.
Dr. Castagnini, do you see grandparents coming in and asking for that vaccine?
Well,
maybe
I'm
not
a pediatrician,
to you because you're a pediatrician. I understand that.
Right.
But generally, among your colleagues, do you see grandparents, mm-hmm. a big rush of grandparents coming in and saying, I want to be vaccinated against the whooping cough because I don't want to give it to my grandchildren?
Well, unfortunately, we do not see that, at least that not that I hear about. In general, if you look at the studies nationwide, the uptake of this vaccine has not been good. We're talking about less than 15% of people in this age are being vaccinated against whooping cough. So I think we need to do a better job in terms of getting out there and reaching all these older adults to get vaccinated and immunized against whooping cough.
One more thing, Dr. Quinlis. Mm-hmm. Once there is an outbreak or a pocket, let's say, breaks out in the Ames area, what's done to contain it? And is it too late for a vaccine then?
No, it's absolutely not too late. Even when we have a cluster of cases, when it gets started, usually we're talking about a small number of people, and it might get, for example, into a daycare center or something like that. But we'll go in, we'll work with the daycare center, making sure that they have all of their children up to date on the vaccine, and then also to make sure that any child that might be coughing or sick from pertussis is not allowed to come into that daycare center. So there's a bunch of things we do, but then we also try to tell the community that this is out there, and because we know so many adults can carry this and pass it on to other people without really realizing it, we try to recommend that they, one, get the vaccine, but two, also realize when they're coughing, even though they may just say, oh, I've got this lingering cold and I can't, or I've got this cough that won't go away, that they realize that this could be pertussis or whooping cough, and they need to make sure they protect people against them.
Dr. Quinlis, okay, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say the best way of doing that is if they think they might have whooping cough, they can go get tested and they can take antibiotics. While it may not make them better very much faster, what it will do is stop them from spreading it to other people.
Dr. Quinlis, you mentioned the mumps earlier and there have been a few outbreaks. Are there any in Iowa right now? Is that a concern of yours along with whooping cough and flu? And are mumps also...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Sure. We have a case or two of mumps, reported to us every month or two. So we do have cases occurring all the time. Fortunately, they occur in populations that are quite well vaccinated, and the vaccine is pretty good. It's priced somewhere between 85 and 90% effective. And what I mean by that is out of every 100 people who are vaccinated, 85 to 90 of them will be fully protected from mumps and won't get mumps even if they're exposed.
Who should get the mumps vaccine?
Well, we give it to basically children. We give it to them first when they're about 2 years of age, and then we give it to them again right before they start school. Now, one of the things we've noticed when we had the mumps outbreak is a lot of the healthcare providers around the state of Iowa had been vaccinated as they were children, but only got one dose. So when we had the mumps outbreak, one of the things we did was make sure that all the healthcare providers got that second dose, which is pretty critical to make sure that their immunity stays up and high and they don't get it and then spread it to their patients.
And should there be boosters for mumps? Let's say that years, decades ago, I received mumps vaccine. Should I, as an older adult now, have a booster in order to protect young people who are around me?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And one of the things they're actually looking at right now is, particularly in outbreak settings, whether they need to go in and give people a third dose of mumps, which is what you're talking about. And maybe Dr. Whitaker could talk a little bit more about this, but my impression right now is that third dose may be appropriate, particularly in outbreak settings.
What about that, Dr. Whitaker?
I think the other thing you need to think about is some of the people who were born before 1957 actually had mumps. And one of the things that's interesting is that when you have the disease, you actually are often better protected than when you've had the vaccine. And so we have to tease out the difference between those who've actually had disease from those who've only been vaccinated. The people who've only been vaccinated might actually need to get boosters later in life.
Mm-hmm. About vaccinations generally, Dr. Whitaker, can everyone be vaccinated against diseases we've been talking about, or are there some who should avoid a vaccine?
So we're pretty careful when we have a live vaccine. So we have live vaccines and we have killed vaccines. And when we have live vaccines, we're pretty cautious about immunizing people whose immune systems are weakened. And that would be patients who have cancer and are getting chemotherapy, or patients who have other immunodeficiency problems. And so we're cautious with that group. We are learning more and more that many of these viruses that are these strains of viruses in the vaccines are pretty safe, even in those settings. But we're pretty careful. Most killed vaccines can be given to almost anyone. Not everybody responds well to them, but we can give them safely.
Any concern among you, Dr. Quindlisk or Dr. Cascagnini, about people who should not receive vaccines? Just those who are immunocompromised?
Definitely, immunosuppression is a contraindication for live vaccines, but people that have had a reaction to a previous vaccine, then that's a precaution, sometimes a contraindication if it was a serious reaction, what we call an anaphylaxis. If somebody develops an anaphylaxis from a vaccine, then they cannot receive that vaccine again. You know, now that we have the flu season, it's important to remember that some egg allergy patients cannot receive influenza vaccine unless they are desensitized to the egg protein. So there are some contraindications, but that for the most part, the entire population are eligible to receive vaccines. And remember that if you immunize the majority, then you provide what's called the herd immunity that Dr. Quinlisk was referring to before. If you immunized the majority of a population, then you prevent that disease from running around that population, and even people that are not immunized will be protected because of that herd immunity.
Dr. Whitaker, you had some comments also about that herd immunity. You've read some research on that?
So there's actually a really interesting study that was done in Canada in the Hutterite populations. And this was a study where they were looking at whether they could vaccinate kids with influenza to protect the elderly who don't respond well to the influenza vaccine. And they found that when they did vaccines up to the teenage years, up to age 18, they actually did a better job of protecting the elderly than when the elderly were vaccinated alone.
So what does that say about how we should regard vaccines?
So I think it tells us that that herd immunity is actually sometimes the best way that we can protect people who are vulnerable.
We're going to take a short break here and then return to our conversation about communicable diseases. I've been talking with Dr. Patricia Quinlisk, Dr. Louis Castagnini, and Dr. Pat Whitaker. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Dean Borg continuing The Exchange, talking with Dr. Patricia Quinlisk, state epidemiologist at the Iowa Department of Public Health, Dr. Louis Castagnini, pediatric infectious disease specialist at Blank Children's Hospital in Des Moines, and Dr. Patricia Winokur, an associate dean at the University of Iowa College of Medicine and a vaccine researcher at the University of Iowa. Dr. Quinlisk, we've been talking about the herd mentality. Is there a danger that some parents will bank on herd mentality and say, that's good enough for me?
Yeah, there certainly is. I've even talked to people who are against vaccines because they look around them and they don't see a lot of these diseases. And that's very true. Vaccines have been enormously successful in reducing the risk of anybody getting some of these diseases. And so then they think, well, I don't need to then get my children vaccinated or myself vaccinated because the disease isn't around anymore. And unfortunately, that just is not something you can bank on. Like I said, we had a child go to India and come back with measles, and then they spread it in this country to people who had not been vaccinated. Here in Iowa, and certainly the mumps came in and probably came in from England. And so we still live in a world where going from one place to another is very easy. So as long as these diseases are anywhere in the world, you need to be protecting yourself. Really, the only vaccine that we don't tell people to get today is smallpox. And the reason we don't tell people to get it is that one truly has been eradicated from the world. But that's the only one we've really managed to get rid of. All the rest of them are still out there, and you can still get exposed to them and get sick with them. So basically everybody still needs to be vaccinated.
And many of us of a certain age are still carrying that smallpox scar on our upper shoulder because that vaccine, that hasn't been eradicated all that long.
No, it was declared eradicated in the late 70s. So that was basically when we stopped vaccinating a lot of people. But I'll tell you, when I joined the Peace Corps in the early 1979, I was still vaccinated against it for the last time because there were still some concerns it might be out there. But then basically very soon after that, they declared it eradicated from the world, and we've not seen it since then, fortunately.
Those of us, or you who are listening to our conversation here today, we'd like to have you join us. Tell us if you've had whooping cough, mumps, flu, a really bad case of the flu. You know, would you advise? What do you think about vaccine? Were you vaccinated? Are you receiving vaccines because you want to protect the children around you? What's the motivation, or why aren't you deciding to take the vaccine? The number to call is 866-780-9100. Dr. Winokur, you are currently doing some research on a flu vaccine for very young children, that is, infants. And why is that being conducted? And is that of your own motivation, or is that with the CDC?
So we study the infant flu vaccine in conjunction with the National Institutes of Health, and we have a group of eight university sites around the country, and we've been studying whether we can improve the vaccine take or the protection of infants between the ages of 6 months and 35 months. It's a population that doesn't respond quite as well to the flu vaccine as you or I do as, you know, young adults or even middle-aged adults. And what they found is that in the elderly, when we increased the amount of flu protein in that vaccine, we actually improved the number of people who were protected. And that same principle could help with the young infants as well. So we're looking at whether we can increase the number of flu proteins in that vaccine to improve the response.
And are you still receiving potential infants to be to receive the vaccine?
We are still looking for kids that could be enrolled. So we're looking for kids between 6 months and 35 months of age.
Is there a danger, Dr. Quinlisk, that we are overprotecting people? Is that a danger?
Well, you have to realize that the diseases that we protect people against, things like influenza, whooping cough, they're all diseases that have pretty high mortality rates. In other words, if you get these diseases, you have a pretty high risk of getting seriously ill and dying. Now, there's a lot of diseases we get that there aren't vaccines for and we don't worry about very much. For example, the common cold. So I think what people need to realize is the diseases that we protect you against by using vaccines are those diseases that are really bad. They're bad players. They could kill you. And those diseases that are not as serious, you know, people get them, but they basically get over them. And we don't really worry about them too much because they tend to be so mild.
Dr. Castagnini, there have been studies disproving the link between vaccinations and autism, but just building on what Dr. Quinlis just said, there's still a lot of concerns out there. What do you tell people who raise that issue with you?
Well, basically, you're raising a very important point. Most of the people that are against vaccine based their motivations on that study that showed that there was some link between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine and autism. Of course, that study has been withdrawn from the literature, and just recently it was known that there was a fraud behind it, or there was like bad science also behind it. And more than 20 studies after that has shown that there's no link between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine and autism. Other theories of people against vaccine is that the mercury-containing vaccines will also be related with autism, which has also been completely disproven by very serious and well-designed studies published in the more reputable journals. So whenever I get a family that is concerned about those links, I just advise them to go to reputable sources. Just using the internet can be very helpful, but also can be very dangerous because you can find all sorts of information there. So you need to go to the and your physician can guide you better on which sources you need to look at. In my opinion, the CDC has a lot of good information, but there are also independent, very well constructed web pages that people can look at that are good information, that are reliable, and that are based in science. So that's my recommendation to these parents.
We asked people if they wanted to call and tell us their experiences or ask a question, and they certainly have. Our screen is full here right now. The number to call is 866-780-9100. Kristen is calling from Iowa City. Go ahead, Kristen.
Yes, I wanted to ask about, you know, you're talking about scientific research and vaccinations, but I think a really important issue is the lack of control groups, is starting with the earliest vaccinations that the United States suggested all people be vaccinated. And I think there aren't very many long-term research studies on a group that chose not to be vaccinated, and also curious about the concept just of letting immunity develop naturally.
Dr. Whitaker, you're a researcher.
Yeah, so you're right in a certain setting that now, today, it would be very difficult to include a group that is not vaccinated for a disease that's now been recommended. But the original studies were done comparing unvaccinated to vaccinated kids. So sometimes you have to go back 10, 20 years to look for those old studies, but they were done with control groups. The question of whether you should let people develop immunity naturally goes to the point of how serious the disease is. And so I think the chickenpox vaccine is a great example of a vaccine that people said, well, people don't get that sick from chickenpox. Why don't we let them develop their own natural immunity? And I think probably Dr. Castagnini can attest to the fact that chickenpox isn't always benign. And we do see very serious consequences in a small number of kids, not everybody, a small number. But those diseases can be quite devastating and cause permanent injury. And so it really is a risk-benefit ratio.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I would like to...
Go ahead, Dr. Castagnini.
Yes, I would like to definitely say that chickenpox can cause severe illness in adolescents. And as you grow older, you can get a more severe illness. And if you're immune compromised, then if you get chickenpox, you can get seriously ill. And there are about like 50 deaths per year, at least at the last time I checked, in the United States due to chickenpox. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that There are some countries where immunizations are not recommended, but to everybody, and some studies have been done in those countries using control groups. And one comes to mind. It's published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is one of the most reputable journals in the medical literature, done in Denmark, looking at children that were immunized, and they compared children that received the MMR vaccine to children that did not receive the MMR vaccine. And the number of children included in this study was hundreds of thousands, which makes that study a very good study to look at effects or outcomes. And they looked at if the children developed autism in both groups, in the children that received the vaccine and the children that did not. And there were no differences. And that's just one, and there are many others. And they included control groups in those studies.
Joe in Cedar Rapids is calling. Joe, go ahead.
Yes, my question is, I've been immunized against just about everything I can possibly imagine from my deployments with the military overseas to different locations. My fiance and her family don't believe in immunizations at all, so they've never been immunized against anything. I'm wondering that because some of the ones that we've received are the weakened viruses, not the killed viruses, and I still get flu shots, things like that. Am I putting them at risk at all? Is there any risk to them to getting something that, you know, from the immunizations itself because they have no immunization history?
Joe, I'm going to take you off the air because of the signal that on your phone, but Dr. Quinlisk will answer your question. Dr. Quinlisk?
Basically, the answer is no. You don't pose a risk to other people. Now, there are some live vaccines that after you receive them, you could pass on that attenuated or weakened virus. But basically, what that's going to do, say you pass on the weakened flu virus to your fiancé, all that's really going to do is immunize her. She'll get a small infection with that, and it's a weakened virus, so she will not get sick, and then she'll just have some immunity to the flu. In the past, there were some vaccines, for example, the live polio, where if it was passed on to a person who's particularly susceptible, it could cause more serious disease, but that vaccine is no longer used in this country. So I would say that basically the risk of you passing on something to a family member after being vaccinated is so low as to basically not be something I would tell people to worry about.
Carlos is calling from Des Moines. Carlos, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Carlos.
Yes, I had a question. When I was a young kid, I ended up having an allergic reaction to the MMR. They found out the second time around when I just kept having seizures and I almost died. And now I have a one-year-old son, and I'm curious as to if I should be concerned about him getting it, or is there anything I can do to avoid him getting it?
Dr. Castagnini, did you hear that question?
Yes, I think I got most of it. If I understand correctly, the caller had a seizure developed after receiving the MMR vaccine, and he's now concerned about his one-year-old son.
Is that right, Carlos?
That's right.
Okay. I'm going to take you off the air then, Carlos.
So, well, this is a very important question. I think the risk of his son getting a similar reaction is basically the same as anybody else in the population, which is extremely, extremely low. My suggestion to parents that have these type of concerns is that they should go ahead and immunize their children because protecting them from these illnesses is extremely important. Definitely there are other vaccines that can cause this type of problem, and again, he should receive all those vaccines.
Any comment, Dr. Whitaker?
No, I agree completely. I think that everybody has a minor risk of having a reaction to a vaccine, but these are rare, extremely rare in almost all cases, and the risk to a son or daughter is no greater than the risk in the general population.
Dr. Quinlisk, I'm going to ask about the long-term effectiveness and the need for boosters. What do we know about the long-term effectiveness of vaccines, such as the DPT, diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus combination that came into use about the time baby boomers were children? Should that age group or older adults be concerned about waning immunities for that DPT shot? Or even the polio vaccine during the 1950s? Mm-hmm.
Right, and each one of the vaccines is a little bit different. In general, we know that the live vaccines, things like MMR and chickenpox, tend to give you longer-lasting immunity and more robust immunity. And by that, I mean that you have a less likelihood of having any symptom if you're exposed to that disease. But we know that the dead vaccines, and that includes the DTP or diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine, those are dead vaccines, and they don't give us as good immunity. And basically, that's why you have to get multiple doses as a child, and that's why the immunity tends to wane. And that's why things like tetanus, we recommend that you get a tetanus booster every 10 years, whether you've stepped on that proverbial rusty nail or not. And so one of the things that they're doing with the tetanus vaccine is, for a long time, the diphtheria has been in the tetanus vaccine. So when you got boosted for tetanus, you got boosted against diphtheria. But now they've actually added the pertussis to it also as a way of trying to make sure that adults have that immunity. And so that is something that's being done. And I would guess that we'll probably need to get those boosters every 10 years or so until we die to ensure that our immunity stays high enough to protect us against those diseases.
Let's take a call from Carolyn, or Caroline. I don't know how to pronounce that.
It's Carolyn.
Carolyn, okay, in Dubuque. Go ahead, Carolyn.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call today. I have twin girls who are now 17 that were born premature with twin-to-twin transfusion, actually. And, you know, we have been immunized when they were younger and everything. But as they've gone through, started school and stuff, and people started doing flu shots, it's the one thing that we opted out not to do for the girls. And although we've had some serious flu things with them, we really looked at boosting their vitamin C and things like that. Now, we caught a lot of flack from grandparents and nurses at school and things like that, that we were like, no, this is something that's really helping them build their own immunities and their immune system to the flu viruses that are out there. And sometimes I think it's a balance of what, you know, it's good for your kids.
Comment? Let's see what Dr. Castagnini has to say about that.
Thank you.
Well, definitely the best way to prevent influenza is immunizing the person. The effectiveness of vitamin C or zinc has not been proven in good literature that I'm aware of. I don't know if Dr. Whitaker has anything on that, but I have not seen any good study that shows that those actually do prevent influenza from happening or ameliorate the case if you do get it. My recommendation to all my patients is always, if you want to prevent influenza, and you should want to prevent influenza, you should get immunized. The vaccine has been proven to be very safe and effective. So I really do not have a good reason not to immunize anybody. Unless, of course, there's a contraindication in that person.
And this is Dr. Quinn. So I'd like to add, because one of her points was, does the immunity that you get from the disease, is that better than the immunity you get from the vaccine? And in general, if you manage to survive the disease, you probably do have better immunity. But that's the problem. In flu, for example, last year with the H1N1, we had a lot of children get very, very sick, end up in hospitals, and even some people, some young, healthy children died. So I think you have to realize that in order to get that maybe a little bit better immunity, you're putting your child at risk of serious disease and death, which I'm sure no mother wants. So, yeah, there are some balances here, but I think you have to understand, too, what the risks are. And the other thing with flu is, say your child last year had H1N1, naturally got the natural flu, got sick with it, got better. They may now have immunity against H1N1, but guess what? This year we got a flu strain called H3N2, which your child will have no immunity to, and we got a B strain of flu, again, that your child will have no immunity to. So even though they had flu last year, they could still get very sick with the flu this year because the immunity is not the right immunity. Now, the good news is the vaccine protects you against all three. And again, that's a critical thing to remember about the vaccine is we're going to protect you against the strains that are going to be out there this year, not just the strains that they might have gotten sick with in the last couple years.
Is there a laxity, maybe a way to say it, in flu vaccine taking this year? That is, we had, you know, people lining up last year. I don't see that this year.
Well, fortunately, this year, one of the things that's very different than last year is we've got plenty of vaccine out there. They think there's somewhere around 160 plus million doses of vaccine out there. And you think we've got a population in this country of 300 million. So lots of vaccine is available. So I don't expect to see any kind of lines, et cetera. But you're right. There's not that sort of feeling of I got to go get that vaccine now because people, I guess, are not as concerned about the flu this year. But I'll tell you, we're starting now to see schools have children get very sick. We've got schools that have had outbreaks in them of the H1N1. We've had outbreaks in long-term care facility among the elderly, and we're just at the very beginning of the flu season right now. So I just, again, would just remind people that the best way of protecting yourself against getting seriously ill with the flu is getting vaccinated.
I'm going to interrupt because we're just running out of time here, and I want to get to Dr. Whitaker before we – Dr. Whitaker, you've been researching avian flu and the others. Does worldwide travel mean that we need to rethink our vaccination program?
So I think worldwide travel has increased our risk here of many diseases that we thought were fairly rare in the United States. Avian influenza has been in Southeast Asia. It's still in the bird populations. It hasn't spread person to person. The government's still interested in trying to develop better vaccines. And we're still interested in developing safer vaccines and more effective vaccines for many diseases.
Well, our thanks today to our three specialists, Dr. Patricia Whitaker from the University of Iowa, Dr. Louis Castagnini, pediatric infectious disease specialist at Blank Children's Hospital in Des Moines, and Iowa State epidemiologist at the Iowa Department of Public Health, Dr. Patricia Quinlisk. The Exchange today was produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. We had production assistance from Ryan Garvey and in Des Moines, John Pemble, and technical support from Dennis Reese. Jeff Schmidt is our executive producer. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Dean Borg, and thanks for joining us.